How many want the story? How many don't want the story? Okay. No, I'm going to dedicate this to you. Since you didn't want, I'm going to donate it. I'm going to dedicate it to you. Pastor Sampson was making visitation rounds when he turned a corner and came upon a young boy trying to sell a lawnmower. "How much do you want for it?" Sampson asked. "I just need enough money to buy a bicycle," the boy explained. After a moment of thought, the preacher asked him, "Okay, what if I gave you $60 for it?" "Mister, you got yourself a deal." The preacher took the mower and began to crank it. He pulled on the cord a few times with no reaction from the machine. The preacher called the boy over and said, "I can't get this mower to start." The little boy said, "My dad says you have to cuss at it to get it started." Pastor Sampson replied, "I'm a minister and I cannot cuss. I've been saved for so long I don't even remember how to cuss." The little boy looked at him with a sparkle in his eye. "Just keep pulling on that cord and it'll come back to you." Now, didn't you like that, Noel? Wasn't that a great story? That's right. I'm blind back there, right? It doesn't work? Well, hopefully the slides will match today. Last Sunday, I began a short 3-week series on the title of which I have taken from Proverbs 14:31. "Whoever is kind to the needy honors the Lord." I should share with you that the inspiration for this series came from a book that my brother gave me a couple years ago for Christmas called When Helping Hurts. It's a book that several in our congregation have read, and it's become fairly popular in many Christian circles. And when reading it, it actually reminded me of another book that we have encouraged folks here to read, and that would be Being Human, for many of the same scriptural truths are appealed to. Well, after reading it through a couple times, I was eager to not only implement many of the principles into our own policies and procedures here at this church, but also share those principles with the whole body, because they have widespread applications, not just for churches, but also relief organizations and certainly for individuals. But first, I wanted to be sure that I wasn't missing something, and so I called together Denny and John and Ted and Steve and Greg, and I gave each of them the book to read as well, and then we met a few times to discuss it. This is actually the sort of thing that we could spend a long time on, several weeks, if not months. But as I explained last Sunday, all I plan to do this time around is to basically just get us started. The traditional ways of helping the poor that we have grown up with, I believe, could stand to be reexamined. And so in this short series, I hope to kind of raise some questions and points that might help us to shift some of our thinking about how we can best help those who lack material resources. Chances are pretty good that in the weeks and months to come that I and maybe even some of the others will occasionally come back to this topic and continue to build on it from time to time. Now, of course, not everything in this series is coming directly from the book. Otherwise, I'd just pass it out and we'd read from it. I'm also working in other scriptures and my own points and observations with the intent of custom fitting the applications for our own setting. In the first half of last week's sermon, we looked at numerous passages that call upon us to be compassionate and generous. Actually, can you make sure that whatever I say matches that up there? Will you help me out? Otherwise, I've got to be turning around all the time. Aaron, you probably are more trustworthy. Can I look to you? Do you get my attention if it needs adjusted? All right, in the first half of last week's sermon, we looked at numerous passages, quite a few, that call upon us to be compassionate and generous. As people of God who are called to imitate Him, our lives should be characterized by benevolence and an eagerness to serve. By nature, we are to be givers, and this, I argued, should be our starting point, our default position, you might say. Instead of being reluctant to help, as though we always have to be talked into it, our frame of mind at all times as imitators of God should be not only a willingness to share, but an eagerness to share. I mean, to be a giver in the same way that God is. In the second half of that sermon, we then turned our attention to this whole business of kindness itself. That is, how can we best demonstrate kindness to those suffering poverty? It takes more than just compassion to help the needy. Obviously, we also have to exercise sound wisdom. Kindness does not necessarily mean giving someone the thing that they are asking you for. In order to provide genuine help, we must address the actual cause of the poverty and not just the symptoms. For again, as stated last week, not all poverty is created equal. And we spent quite a bit of time on this in particular. To just summarize that, if the primary cause of poverty is a lack of knowledge, for instance, an inability to manage one's finances, for instance, then the answer is education and training or counseling. If the cause is sin, an addiction to sin, something sinful, or even laziness, then the answer is repentance and or discipleship and possibly evangelism. Now, the same would be true for poverty that results from following the ideals of a false religion or holding to a fatalistic worldview. If the primary cause of poverty is oppression by powerful people, then the answer is to become their advocate and help them to get justice. If, however, the primary cause is a genuine lack of material resources, then the answer is to share our resources with them. Food, clothing, homes, whatever it might be, including money. We generally make the mistake of thinking that everyone who is poor simply because they don't have enough money, and therefore the remedy is to give them money. But this common belief, which is so ingrained in most of us, is simply not true. Genuine kindness requires us to determine the cause itself and then act accordingly. Today, we're going to build on that. We're going to build on what we covered last week. And so if you missed because you were teaching Sunday school or in the nursery or you're at a Michael Jackson tribute concert, let me encourage you to go visit our website. And there you'll find the sermon, the handout, and the notes on the slides. Oh, well, good for you. I didn't have you in mind or anything. All right. We're now ready for the third point. Does that have point number three?
Maybe.
Okay. When it comes to poverty itself, it's very important that we do not do for others what they can do for themselves. And this is really a huge one. It may sound harsh at first, but it is here where we can safely say that more times than not, our helping results in hurting in more ways than one. When we step in, we take away the incentive for the person to help themselves. And so we end up making them even more dependent upon us and others, something that the Bible, as you know, expressly forbids. We looked at those passages last week. And again, just to be clear here, I'm not referring to orphans and earthquake victims and quadriplegics, but those who are able to do things for themselves but won't. Keep in mind that the ultimate goal should be to help them function as human beings made in the image of God, who can take care of themselves and become contributing members of society. The goal of all believers as God's universal church is to help restore all people, you know, poor and the not so poor alike, to a full expression of humanness, to be what God created us to be, human beings who glorify the Lord by living in right relationship with Him and with others. And we can actually undermine this when we take over and do for others what they can do for themselves, even when we do it in the name of kindness. And so we have to be very, very careful that in our efforts to alleviate poverty, that we don't end up contributing to the cause of that poverty. For example, as we have noted, some people are poor because they are enslaved to sinful addictions. Others because they are just downright lazy and unwilling to work. Others because of irresponsible spending habits and so on. In these cases, the poverty, as you see, is primarily spiritual, not physical. The lack of physical goods in their lives is the result of deeper spiritual issues. And the suffering they experience from their lack of material goods actually helps them to see the spiritual problems and can become an opportunity to address those deeper issues. And so one of the worst things we can do for them is to simply put a Band-Aid on it and make the pain go away temporarily with a handout. And in so doing, we actually help prevent them from coming to grips with the deeper issues. All right, so let me be clear here, though, about something. The issue isn't whether they deserve to be helped or not. That's not the issue. The issue is what is the best way to help them. If we're going to do things for them that they are able to do themselves, then we are not helping them at all. But there may be things that they can't do for themselves that do require acts of kindness and generosity and compassion on our part. Counseling, training, evangelism, discipleship, helping them learn a trade, work with them in other ways to become employable, the list goes on. In fact, our kindness to them might actually require something from us even more valuable than money and material resources. That would be an investment of our time and energy. But on top of this, there is yet another problem with doing things for people that they should be doing for themselves. We not only hurt them, we hurt ourselves. We end up feeding this ungodly attitude in us that we seldom think about, but it is an attitude that is deeply ingrained in many upper and middle class American Christians, and that is paternalism. And it comes in a variety of forms, but basically it is this idea that because I am not suffering poverty myself, especially poverty caused by sinful addictions or laziness or other self-inflicted reasons, that I am better than those who do, that I have it all together. And because I have it all together, it only makes sense that I do things for those who don't have it all together, because that's my gift, my service, my calling to mankind. In fact, many people find a good measure of satisfaction and self-fulfillment in mothering the needy. Oh, you poor thing. Here, let me do that for you. And it's one handout after another. There is a kind of riding on the white horse, saving the day thing going on. It is as if we don't think that those who are needy are able to do anything for themselves. And so in order to stroke our ego by helping them, we end up belittling the very people we are trying to assist. At its root, of course, as you can see, is a subtle underlying arrogance, something we probably don't even realize or even think about. But it comes down to thinking of ourselves higher than we ought to think. Furthermore, it is just an outright delusion. Just because we live a higher standard of living does not mean that we are God's answer to the world or the answer to poverty itself. We may not suffer from physical poverty, but we certainly have our share of spiritual poverty, as in thinking that we are God's gift to the poor. That's a symptom. Middle to upper class Americans are also characterized by high rates of divorce, sexual addiction, substance abuse, depression, materialism, to name a few. I mean, talk about poverty. And so this paternal thing of where I am the hero, the savior, which often characterizes the attitudes of Christians as when we do things for others that they should be doing for themselves, not only contributes to our own arrogance, but it actually prevents us from coming to grips with our own needs and our own shortcomings, coming to grips with our own poverty. So again, as a general rule here, it's bad for them and it's bad for us. Number four. Discern what is actually needed, relief or rehabilitation or development. The question is, what does the situation actually call for? Failure to make the necessary distinction and act accordingly is one of the most common reasons poverty assistance efforts often do more harm than good. Relief can be defined as the urgent and temporary provision of emergency aid in order to reduce suffering from a natural or man-made crisis. The objective here is to simply stop the bleeding. Outside help is needed, and it is needed right now. The Good Samaritan taking care of the helpless man along the roadside is an excellent example of relief applied appropriately. Rehabilitation begins as soon as the bleeding stops. It is more of a process, seeking to restore the person to his previous condition by working with him. For instance, earthquake victims in Haiti working with and alongside American teams for their own recovery, as in rebuilding their homes and businesses and communities. Or, in the case of the town drunkard who can't hold a job, rehabilitation in this situation could, for instance, consist of working with him in overcoming his addiction, as being his sponsor or a mentor, and helping him obtain necessary job training so that he can become employable. Whatever is needed to get him out of the gutter, so to speak, into a responsible lifestyle. Or, in the case of a person who won't work, maybe his laziness is due more to the fact that he is without hope. You know, he's got this attitude, who cares? None of this means anything anyway. Efforts of rehabilitation would therefore involve addressing those deep-seated doubts and ideas that have crippled him, a false view of life, you know, fatalism. Evangelism and apologetics could be a part of that. The basic idea behind rehabilitation is that of recovery. Something needs to be restored, made right. It could be physical, it could be spiritual. Development is also a process, but it is a much longer one. You might think of this as a lifelong process that all of us are to be engaged in. Here, the objective is to move everyone, those being helped and those helping, closer to a right relationship with God and with others. It is this task of all of us becoming complete in our humanness, of being what God intended us as humans to be, you know, made in His image. So again, think of some of the principles we learned from the book Being Human. For instance, as the materially poor develop, they are better able to fulfill their calling of glorifying God by working and supporting themselves and their families with the fruits of that work. And as the materially wealthy develop, they are able to become more humble and dependent upon God, more willing to share, less arrogant and paternal. And work for them eventually ceases to be a means of simply obtaining even more wealth, but as a way of serving God and even serving others. Development is an investment that we all make in ourselves and in others. In many ways, you could compare it to the principles of sanctification that we've been talking about in recent months. Ultimately, the goal is to see every person conformed into the image of Christ. And so after relief and after rehabilitation, there continues to be much work that needs to be done. It involves our ongoing investment in everything, individuals, communities, the world itself. And that investment involves our time, our energy, our resources, our money, I mean, the works. From a certain perspective, you might say that the goal of development is to see everyone earn money, spend money, save money, and give money in a way that honors God in all things. It involves the ongoing effort to alleviate all poverty in everyone's life, financial, material, and spiritual. But one of the biggest mistakes that North American churches make by far is that we often apply relief in situations where rehabilitation or development is the appropriate response. Relief, again, is something that should be immediate and temporary. Always think of those two words. When you hear the word relief, think of stop the bleeding. The goal is to get someone or a group of people back on their feet so that they can participate in and work for their own recovery and restoration. And so, for instance, when churches pay people's light bills or buy them groceries or fill their tanks up with gas, while that may be appropriate thing to do in some situations, oftentimes, it is just more relief effort being added to previous relief, and it goes on week after week, month after month. And they go around hitting everybody up, the Salvation Army, the county trustee's office, all the churches in the Yellow Pages, all the relief organizations, and so on. And therefore, as you can see, they never assume responsibility for their own livelihood. Everyone in town keeps them in this state of dependency with their soup kitchens and food banks and benevolent funds. And what is called for here, obviously, is not relief, but rehabilitation, financial counseling, job training, accountability, disciplined spending, and so forth, oversight. And they're not going to be eager to embrace that kind of program if they are able to get all that they want from the free handouts every week. One thing that I have really come to appreciate is this. There are many legitimate ways of helping the poor. Rehabilitation and development are just as valid in the eyes of God as relief. In fact, each church actually needs to assess their own resources and expertise and experience and find the niche that they can best minister in. Not every church should feel as though they have to provide some kind of relief ministry for their communities. In fact, for many churches, it would be better if they didn't do something like that, because to do it right requires more than just good intentions. Sometimes visitors who are expressing an interest in our church will ask me, "So what kind of a ministry do you have here for the poor?" And they are expecting an answer similar to the one they get from other churches that they have visited. We have a food bank. Let me go show it to you. Or once a month, we collect grocery items from our neighbors and distribute them to run-down neighborhoods in town. Or we take turns helping out at the St. Mary's soup kitchen. These sorts of things. And so when I respond to the question with an answer that doesn't fit in the relief box, well, they look at me as though I'm trying to pull a fast one on them. You know, as if the answer I gave doesn't have anything to do with helping the poor. So let me perhaps the best way to paint this is for me to give everyone here a quick run through. I think our church would do better to provide relief on an as-needed basis when it becomes obvious that relief is what is needed. And the key word here would be obvious. Take, for instance, something we did a couple years ago when the earthquake hit Haiti. We found a responsible Christian organization that specialized in sending medical teams to areas of the world hit by natural disasters. And they were going to Haiti. And you may remember we took up an offering for that. I think we are also suited here to provide relief in-house, something the Bible actually encourages. And we've done that with a number of our families here who have gone through unexpected hardships. But as far as paying people's light bills from those who just call up the church out of the blue, well, this is the sort of thing that we have done in the past, but I really don't think it's our niche. We lack the time and the manpower and experience and expertise to do that kind of ministry in a way that would actually and properly honor the Lord. And there are plenty of churches and organizations in town who have made this kind of thing their specific ministry. I'm of the conviction that we need more on the rehabilitation and development end. Ministries that we support that are more in line with providing rehabilitation and development would include, for instance, a friend's house. This is a perfect example. Tom and Suja going into Burkina Faso, one of the poorest countries of the world, to work with the Jula people as a teacher and a doctor, providing assistance on a number of different levels. Evangelism, medical care, teaching life skills, and so on would be another. I would even argue that our support for William Lane Craig fits within the development stage of helping the poor. Such a ministry encourages people to think and act correctly about God and the value of life and the hope of the gospel itself. As you know, Craig is quite effective in exposing the falsehoods of non-Christian religions and worldviews, many of which contribute to poverty, especially those that are rooted in fatalism and hopelessness. And for that matter, any effort to protect the preborn from abortion would qualify as helping the poor. Really does. For who is more destitute than someone who has absolutely nothing? And the only thing that they do have, their fragile life, is now being stolen. This is an example of poverty because of injustice. And so advocates who could speak out against the oppression of the powerful are called for, along with efforts to change unjust laws and help society come to grips with the truth. And so organizations like the one Seth works for and the ministry of Scott Klusendorf and Right to Life and Women's Care Center, all of which we support in one way or another, they are all in the business of poverty alleviation. So I think you kind of get the idea here. We tend to think of helping the poor in the narrow context of relief, of giving someone food, clothing, shelter, medical care, money. But helping the poor also involves rehabilitation and development. And these efforts are just as valid, just as necessary, though admittedly they generally aren't that sexy, so to speak. They don't inspire the same kind of enthusiasm or support. All right, number five. Is that showing five? You didn't put any of those silly pictures of frogs and bicycles or anything up here, did you? There's a whole story to that for visitors. All right, we need to recognize, number five, we need to recognize our own poverty. This goes back to that popular saying, some people are so poor that all they have is money. I already talked about paternalism, our poverty of humility, but there are a host of other qualities middle-class American Christians tend to be spiritually bankrupt in as well. And I talked about high divorce rates, substance abuse, materialism, depression, sexual addictions, and more. But two big ones that especially characterize the culture of the affluent, of which we all belong to in some way, would be pride and greed. Let's take work as an example here. Obviously, this is something we need to encourage those who are poor because of laziness to do. Work is something God ordained back in the Garden of Eden. It was and continues to be an act of worship. And this is why we must encourage work, not just so that people can earn wages, but also that they may fulfill their true humanness as God has designed it to be. On the other hand, when work is done to glorify oneself or merely to achieve even more wealth, then it becomes a worship of false gods. Men especially tend to define themselves by their occupations. We place a value upon others based upon the kind of work they do. And we do this to ourselves as well. Occupations then become kind of a status symbol, whether we admit it or not. And so how we work and how we understand work and how we understand who we are really working for, it all matters. And so in our attempts to help the needy in this area, we need to be mindful that we can be just as guilty before God of corrupting His plan as the lazy are. For them, they don't want to work. For us, we work for the wrong reason. Both are sin. Both demonstrate spiritual poverty. Both need to be repented from. This is but one example. Another one would be spending habits. We could think less of the poor who indulge in unwise spending habits, who buy things they don't need. We roll our eyes, shake our head. What are they thinking? What are they doing? Well, certainly that's a problem. But should we not be mindful of the fact that we do the same thing? Should we not at least approach them in a spirit of humility, knowing that we also have bought things where the expense could not be justified? And on we could go. But the point is, we all stand before God equally guilty of sin. We all stand before Him, as we've said in the past, with empty hands on the same level playing field. We all have areas of poverty in our lives, spiritual poverty, and therefore humility is called for. In our efforts to assist those who lack material resources, whether it be through giving them money or providing job training or standing up as advocates against injustice or teaching them how to set up a budget, with that generosity, we should be showing, with that generosity that we should be showing, we must have genuine humility and a genuine recognition of our own shortcomings before God. Our perspective should be less about how we are going to fix the materially poor and more about how we can walk together asking God to fix both of us. And finally for this morning, number 6, you will remember the words of Jesus, "I am sending you out like sheep among wolves, therefore be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves." Now, he wasn't thinking of relief organizations when he said that, but the principle here of being shrewd as snakes certainly applies to many areas of life. The dictionary offers the following words as synonyms of shrewd: quick, discerning, perceptive, keen, discriminating, intelligent. In other words, be careful, be cautious. Scams will be inevitable, and you will probably be taken from time to time. But you are responsible for their good and yours to prevent that as much as possible. So get wisdom, and a good place to start would be the book of Proverbs, because it has a lot to say about managing money and dealing with people who do not manage money well and that sort of stuff. Not only do we face cons who want to pick our pockets, pretending to be down and out, but there seems to be a whole industry out there of organizations that are not all that they appear to be. And I've been a victim of this, and I'm sure many of you have as well. Things are just a bit different today than they were in biblical times. Okay, Jesus is walking through a small village and a crowd gathers around. He stops and begins teaching them about the kingdom of God, and then he tells everyone to sell their possessions and give to the poor. When they hear the words, "give to the poor," they see things differently than what we see. What comes to mind would be the crippled man at the city gate begging for food. They know who he is. The blind woman who hangs out at the city well all day long. They know her. They see names and faces of specific widows and orphans and the truly needy. The words "give to the poor" meant something different to them. It had a personal connection. They knew who lived in poverty because they could not care for themselves, and who lived in poverty because they were lazy or wasted all their money on wine, women, and song. And they knew who the scammers were in the village. But it's not so easy with us. When we hear the words of Jesus to give to the poor, we see images of TV commercials, advertisements in Christian magazines, pictures found in mass mailings, and we don't really even know who these people are. An organization calls us up on the phone asking for a contribution. It's hard today to distinguish fact from fiction. We send one of these charities a check. We have to take them at their word. You know, how much actually goes to the need itself and how much goes to the overhead? or how much goes to fundraising, or how much of the cut goes to the agent on the phone. And even among those that are above board and responsible, how can we be sure that the help they provide is actually helping instead of hurting? Are they making things worse, for instance, by freely distributing handouts to those who actually need something different instead? Are we not obligated to exercise some discernment and wisdom to do some research? Is God really honored if we just recklessly give without checking out things first? Maybe we can't dot every I and cross every T, but we should at least show some due diligence in this. And this is one of the reasons our church tends to favor smaller ministries over big charities. It's one of our intentions here. We have kind of an unwritten rule. We have to be on a first-name basis with the ministries we support. Bill Craig, Scott Klusendorf, Tom and Suja, Pam Durdall, and the others that work at a friend's house. Even with those ministries that we occasionally give financially support to, we want a personal hands-on connection, a first-hand understanding of the ministry and its philosophy, rather than just reading something prepared in a slick brochure. However, many of the large charities do a great work, and they do deserve to be supported. And if you are inclined to financially support them, any of them, then I would at least recommend that you check them out using these two watchdog organizations, because they monitor the income and expenses of the more popular charitable organizations and rate them accordingly. And that would be MinistryWatch.org and CharityNavigator.org, which I think I have there in your handout. And it, you know, because although it may be hard to believe, not all Christian charities are created equal. Okay, next week we will continue this part of the series with a look at short-term mission trips. And if time allows, I'd like to take some of those scenarios that I led off with last Sunday at the beginning of the sermon and apply some of these principles we've been discussing to those situations. Maybe have a little fun with that if time allows, but I certainly want to spend a good deal of focus on the whole thing of short-term mission trips. How many have been on a short-term mission trip? Quite a few. Okay. I may have been on more than one. All right. Still quite a few. All right. Very good. All right. I forgot to ring the bell for the Sunday school classes, but let's go ahead and stand. If the musicians could come forward, and we'll bring the kids in. We'll continue with their time of worshiping the Lord in song.